This is Karen Brewster, and today is October 12th, 2021, and I'm here with Leo Rasmussen at his home in Fairbanks, Alaska. We are also joined by his wife, Erna, who may chime in a little bit.
I hope she does.
So I want to at least introduce her in case we hear her voice. And this is for the Iditarod National Historical Trail Project Jukebox, project for the National Historic Trail Alliance.
Correct. I'm
saying the organization correctly. So thank you, Leo, for agreeing to let me come visit you today.
It's a pleasure, my dear.
And I know you've been interviewed.
I work best to questions.
Yes. So. Well, I have a whole pile of them. Whether we get to them all or not, doesn't matter. But I always start these interviews just with a little bit of introduction about who you are. And I know you've been in Alaska a long time and have done a lot of things. So when did you come to Alaska? From where and why?
Came to Alaska to continue my college education at the University of Alaska in the fall of 1962. So this is my 59th year in Alaska, and I have no intention on departing by any means. Been so fortunate to have been here at a time that we could do something stupid and crazy like this eight-letter word called Iditarod. And I'll respond to your questions in regard to that, because so many other things are interwoven as a part of what took place with Iditarod. I first met Dorothy Page in 1964. They were holding a woman's
Beta Sigma Phi.
Yeah, Beta Sigma Phi in Nome. And one evening at John Slagle's house, another elder of Alaska's history, and it went on till 2 or 3 mm-hmm. o'clock in the morning, typical Alaska back then. Dorothy Page showed up, who later became known as the mother of the Iditarod. She probably had more to do with introducing and moving forward Iditarod based on its history than any other single person alive. Dog mushers, a total. And she was the spark plug that brought it together and made it grow out of this process, because mail was hauled on a trail back then, and it took dogs to move freight and people up and down the trail. There weren't any airplanes flying back then. There weren't any boats in the middle of winter that would go anywhere. There was very few machines that could be trusted to travel more than maybe 40, 50 miles, period, on flat land, not going up the hills and through the passes and crossing flowing rivers and the stuff that takes place all winter long. And she conceived that there was something extremely valuable about the history of moving freight and gold and people up and down the trail as it expanded. Most people think dogs were the only thing that ever moved on the trail, but they used several different kinds of animals to move the freight on the trail, the least of which was reindeer. Mm-hmm. And they actually trained the reindeer to haul or pull sleds on the trail. I've never seen any reports of how successful it was, but they used it for a couple years, and there was actually a mail contract let to one of the people who had the reindeer that they had trained to pull sleds on the trail. So it's a real unusual mixed testament to testifying of how you might try to do something, how it existed, let alone the fact they tried to put in a communications link clear back in the 1860s between the United States and Russia. And they actually went all the way across there, putting telephone poles in. Of course, by the time next year came around, the telephone poles had been squeezed back out of the ground. But that was all part of Alaska's history of trying to move into the future with communication.
So how did you end up in Nome?
Well, I usually tell people I got on an airplane.
You didn't dog mush then?
No, dog mushing became a part of my life more than sleds and dogs. I was sort of an organizer and a person who created things that made the Iditarod survive to today. Mm-hmm. I got on a plane the first summer after finishing my first year here at the university. The only job that came about was with the Department of Fish and Game, and I worked out of the Nome Fish and Game office half of the summer in Golovin with the fishery down there, and the other half of the summer in Kotzebue with the fishery. And that was sort of my opening to living in Bush, Alaska, which I've done for, I'm pushing 60 years, pushing hard.
So did you get your degree from the university?
I got a degree of hard knocks, my young lady. I knew enough, I guess, after a year and a half at the university here, that the education is out there in the world. You can sit there and read all the books and study everything you want to. That doesn't make you functionable on the other side of the line. Mm-hmm. And I gave up at 3.5 years of college, not here, but various mm-hmm. other places, business college, a university, and a college in Michigan. And I began to experience Alaska, and that first summer, right, going those three different places, moving from Golovin all the way to Kotzebue on a ship. The ship, and I'm trying to remember his name now, they called the ship the Bering Sea, but you know, how many ships have been named the Bering Sea that are in the Bering Sea? And it was 110 feet long. It was a fish processing ship, Second World War vessel. If it had ever run into an iceberg, it would have sunk on sight because Second World War, they built those ships to last for two sailings, period.
And where were you born? Where?
In Michigan.
In Michigan. So you came to Alaska from Michigan?
Yes. My father was a general practice doctor back when general practice did everything except refer you to some other doctor. And I grew up with that background. He worked as a county coroner and went there with the intent of changing the context of just being who could win an election to become the coroner to being a person who was qualified and had a medical background to become a medical examiner. And he made that change by participating in the election, and eventually he got more votes than any other political person in the county, and they changed it to medical examiner. Experiences throughout life. You've been through them. God, how many things have you been through one way or another? At least heard the recordings of that. It's what you do out there that makes the difference, not what you consume in the process.
So you moved to Nome in 1964 then?
Because of my summer in 63, I consider it, that was my awakening. But there was a few other things that took place in between. Summer, the spring of 64, I worked in the North Slope. You know what was there on the North Slope in 1964?
Nothing.
Robin Nodwells.
Oh, right.
That was it. Everything was little camps of Robin Nodwells. I don't know if you've seen one or not. They were probably the best vehicle at that juncture for working in the Arctic.
I've seen more recent Nodwells. I don't know that I've seen those early ones.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've seen a recent Nodwell. I'm in no rush to see another one.
But I know the concept, the big tires.
Yeah, and the big track, so you didn't sink. And we were drilling 200, 300 foot holes, dropping nitrocarbonitrate down there, setting it off, and then recording the reflected sounds coming back up. And, here I am, 20 some years old, young kid. I'm sitting on top of 1 mile south of the Prudhoe Bay well site. I can say that today. I didn't know it then.
You didn't know it then, no.
And you could see we had access to this highly paid private information, and you could look at the bells as it went through the patches of oil, and it'd be fractured all the way down. All these different little recording microphones that are outside be fractured, just jagged. Wow. And then all of a sudden it'd smoothly bell out, all these little microphones doing the same thing, and then it'd jagged again, and then it'd bell out again. Oil, gas.
Neat.
And, I can say, had I been a little better off and had I had $100,000 in my pocket, I could have owned that well site.
Hindsight is 20/20.
It went for $10,000 there.
Oh, that's
cheap.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the historic trail, the Iditarod Historic Trail, why don't we talk about how you got involved in that effort to get the Iditarod Trail recognized as a historic trail?
There's a process, and Judy can tell you that.
But how you got involved and decided that?
I wasn't selected for the original committee people to put the big book together.
Right, the comprehensive plan.
We've got one out there, that big book.
Well, Howard got the letter from Joe, and he brought it to you.
But we're talking about the historic trail part of it.
Well, yeah, you said earlier before we were recording that the sled dog race, the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, was a factor in getting the trail designated.
Oh, absolutely.
So tell me about that.
No question about it. Is in 73, and you would have had to have gone through that race to understand how close we came to killing long-distance dog mushing forever. Mm-hmm. Forever. And I'm not kidding you. When those, and I can't remember how many started now, but when all of them went out, they had no previous knowledge of what they were getting into other than they were going to mush to Nome. And they all had different ideas. Ern and I were there for the second start of the Iditarod, and we saw things happening then that must have been the first one that were just as horrible. I can say that today. I wouldn't have said it 5, 10, 15 years ago for fear somebody might feed on it to kill the Iditarod. But Iditarod started, nobody had any idea of what long distance dog mushing required for nutrition.
Right.
Those animals on the trail were being fed, I hate to say it, garbage, but nobody knew what was needed to bulk an animal up and keep those muscles going and keep the nutrition going through the body, enough moisture coming in to keep the body from shrinking.
Right.
And that first year, had there been better news coverage, would have killed the Iditarod.
Well, wasn't there a race in 1967?
Oh, yeah, there were pre-races.
That kind of...
They were half, or less than half.
Okay.
There were three of them, two of them that went round trip, I think, to McGrath and back. And there was another one that was shorter that came back, 67, 69, and I think there was one in 71. And mind you, it's getting fuzzy upstairs, so.
Right.
And one of them was shorter, and it may have been the first one. But that first one, there were 60, I think 67 mushers that signed up for it. You can check the records, and it's blurry.
Well, yeah, but the fact that all of you working on the Iditarod race and that knew that the trail was important, and so you were able to fight for the designation. Is that kind of how?
Well, 70. That is several years ahead of the start of Iditarod.
Right.
So in 73, they ran the race and 23 finished. Howard Farley came in 20th. We weren't sure he was going to make it. And John, was it John Schultz was the last one? I'm trying to remember. Because we held, it was John Schultz. As we held a final banquet for him, he was the last one to come in. He was way last, yeah. Period.
And back then it was weeks.
And as we were going through the celebration and honoring him, and he got, I don't know, a $250 check for finishing, which was totally unexpected. And you had the banquet for him. He finally stood up at the end of the banquet and he said, "I've come to Nome to get drunk, and I'm drunk." And he sat down. That was the only thing he said at his banquet.
He's just glad he
made it. "I came to get drunk, and I'm drunk."
You could say he was just glad to make it.
Yeah.
But wasn't it that you guys had been doing the race and you realized how important the history of the trail was?
Oh, I don't think there was any reason to believe we didn't understand there was a value there that was far greater than what we were doing. Because had we not had that feeling, had not enough of us had that feeling, the Dorothy Page, the Joe Reddington Sr., the Howard Farleys, you look at those original group pictures on the south end of the trail, had it not been there, the race would have been gone. I mean, there might be something else going on the trail today. There are people riding bicycles and walking and running and so forth. But the original concept of dogs on the trail came so close to not being. It took 3 years to clean up, I call it the mess, clean up the mess of learning how to treat these animals, these beautiful animals on the trail, so that they could not only survive from one end to the other, but they became professional athletes that were going from one end to the other, like it was back when they were hauling 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of freight.
Right. But the historic trail, that designation starts in Seward, and the race never started
in Seward. And that primarily is... there were reasons. Anchorage had
money,
resources. Seward could have never coughed up the kind of resources. I mean, that played in why it started in Anchorage. There's probably a hundred other people could tell you there is a different reason it started, but that was the big thing. At least we knew we could have the finances to put up the banners and get the thing going. Originally, that first year, we went the whole distance. Now it goes to Eagle River and they pick up and go right. out somewhere out in
because
the country.
Because there's no snow.
Well, no snow. It's traffic. It's right. There are houses all over right. the place that weren't there in 1973.
Yeah. So, well, and Joe Reddington was living in Kinnick yep. at that time, and it didn't start in Kinnick. It started in Anchorage.
It started in Anchorage. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We were there for the second start.
Well,
there are pictures of both she and I down mm-hmm. there with the start line in the back down on Mulcahy Park. Yeah, down mm-hmm. in the park.
Right.
That's where it started then.
When was it Joe Reddington wrote that letter to see if it...
To Howard?
Yeah.
In June or July of 73.
And what was that letter?
No, 72, I'm sorry. Joe wrote a letter to Howard Farley, basically asking Howard... he talked as if he had this thing all put together. He never had anything together except his dogs.
So that was a letter to say, hey, I want to do this race?
Well, he said, do you think it's possible to have a race from Anchorage to Nome? Let me know. And came over to you, and you talked, and then you
but Dorothy Page
apparently
Howard has that letter.
Yeah, I've seen a copy
yeah.
of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think Dorothy Page had given Joe the incentive of this race, and then he took it from there.
Right, but then Howard talked to you. Were you mayor? No, you weren't mayor yet. Were you?
I was on the city council.
Okay.
Then. And we had just gone through the flood of 72, mm-hmm. It washed out Front Street,
right.
And, because we were holding our city council meetings in the old federal building on the second floor
yeah.
at that time. And I came to councilman's comments and I said, there's a big race coming to Nome. It was big concepts anyway. And I'm hoping
they told you were crazy.
Well, they all looked at me, you know, he's gone really over the deep end this time, you know. That was the concept.
Right.
You're going to have a dog race all the way from where to where,
right.
And there hasn't been anyone on that trail since 1920 whatever. He had to be crazy. And I was the first one to make an announcement in Nome. I don't know, Howard may have said something to somebody.
Right.
He was working as a butcher in Nome throughout that period of time and fishing in the summer. That's how I ran into Joe Reddington and Unalakleet. They were down there fishing at the same time. A little out of water over the dam. Yeah.
Well, so do you remember how you got involved in the Trail Alliance for it becoming the historic trail?
There was a Democrat that was president at the time. Was it Carter? Because he wouldn't appoint me to anything because I was a Republican.
I can't remember. 1978 was when the National Historic, when the Iditarod Trail was added into the National Historic Trail thing.
Yeah, but that came after this pre-committee.
Right.
Put together the document that brought about the trail itself.
Okay.
And there was a federal...
Oh, there was the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation report? Is that what you're talking about? That recommended...
I think you're right.
That recommended that the Iditarod should be included?
Well, recommended the Iditarod to become what eventually became the historic trail.
Right.
It was the first historic trail moved into the National Trails Act.
Right.
it was the driving force to bring all these other historic trails, which didn't have what we had, and that was a driving force to move it into the national, into this new law that amended the National Trails Act for historic trails. Mm-hmm. It's all coming back
right
to me now.
Well, I have 1978 as the year of the act.
Yeah, that would have been the amendment of the National Trails Act to bring historic trails into it. Up to that time, it was solely scenic trails.
That's right, just recreational trails. Okay.
No, scenic and recreational.
They were just scenic and recreational.
Yeah.
Okay. And so were you involved at that point?
Well, I was on the periphery, I guess you would say, because I wouldn't be on there because I wasn't a Democrat. And the people that were on there were either NP, no party, or Democrats. And as soon as we got a Republican president, I was asked to serve on the committee.
And I didn't realize that they were presidential committees.
Well, they were probably authorized by Congress, but had to be signed off by the president.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
typical, that's the way it goes.
Well, yeah, I think of it as a local state council. I didn't realize it would have to go through the...
No, this feds. Was national.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you work with the Alaska's congressmen and senators on any of this?
Yeah, I wrote lots of letters somewhere along the line. We worked together as a committee in the beginning, and boy, I've got, she keeps hollering, I've got piles of paper out there.
Yeah, you do.
It's so much junk and it's fireplace place.
Yeah. No, go in the archives. It's good organizational history.
Yeah. Where is Alaska's organizational history?
No, for this organization.
Do you know where it is?
Well, it's all over the place.
Yes, and none of it's in Alaska either.
I was thinking the history of the...
It's in a warehouse in Seattle.
Oh, yes, the National Records. Yes. Well, so you first served on the advisory council...
After we changed presidents.
So that would have been...
And that would have been Reagan, I think, appointed me. Yeah. I've got that letter here somewhere, too.
So do you remember how that advisory council kind of worked and what you guys did?
We had... it was... Quite honestly, it was sort of a sad state of affairs. We worked under... The Department of,
BLM.
Yeah, worked under BLM. And whoever was head of Alaska was the person who either moved the committee forward or did nothing. And we had a lot of nothing. I won't blame anybody personally, but I sure can remember the names.
Well, if you can remember the names of who was involved without feeling like you're blaming.
I'm blaming because the committee would have a meeting and this group would come together in Anchorage. I think we met once in Seward and some, just between us, some stupid stuff took place. They thought it was funny, you know, playing jokes and so forth, but it took us quite a while to produce this document, which was pretty well written as it was, and going through and trying to piece things into it that belonged in there that were part of the history of why we were doing this historic trail in the first place. And we finally got the document together, it was approved. And now, mind you, the Iditarod race has been going are throughout this period of time. Thank God, by the third time it was run, it was a driving force.
Now, is that document, is that the comprehensive plan that's the, that out, yeah, it's thick and it outlines what should happen, and they're, you know, want to do exhibits, or we want to do things.
I've got a couple copies out there, too.
And how to manage it and maintain the trail.
Yep.
Okay.
And the historic part of it.
Right.
As there's, you see there are only, at one point, there are two pieces of the race trail, but there are umpteen pieces of historic trail that aren't on the race trail.
Oh, so the race trail does not follow the historic trail exactly.
It does almost entirely until it gets to, oh, what the heck's that checkpoint that they, nobody's there.
Flat Iditarod.
No, yeah, Iditarod's one of them, then there's another one. The trail from Iditarod to the Yukon River did not exist. We actually got, in one of our meetings, we got the Secretary of Interior to endorse creating that trail to the Yukon River for the race.
Oh, that's not part of the historic.
It's not truly historic.
Where would the historic have gone then?
Well, the historic, there, mind you, there were little gold camps all
right.
over, so these little trails went, and once you got over the mountain pass, they went off this way, and they went off that way, and they came back together because they hauled mail down from Fairbanks down the river
mm-hmm.
to, you know, the Tanana to the Yukon, and it spread out from there. There were probably half a dozen pieces of the trail that have never been recognized because this was such an immense undertaking. Look how long it took to put the Appalachian or
right.
Appalachian Trail together.
Right. Well, I was thinking that designating it as a one solid through trail, all those little pieces are going to get left out because they're little pieces.
That's what happened.
The idea was to make it one thing all the way.
And when the Iditarod had this little stupid race that went through often one of these gold trails and then ran out a trail between that and the Yukon River, so it would come back to the Yukon River and Anvik and then go on up
mm-hmm.
to go over to Unalakleet. That all sort of changed the concept of what you could really do, and we could have done a lot more. I was working with the group, and I couldn't get them to go with it, to include in that the rest of the Yukon River to the Canadian border. Because that was just as much a part of the Iditarod Trail as the original Iditarod Trail coming out of Seward.
Right.
And I never got it.
Well, it was its own trail, in a way.
Well, that was part of the problem. Somebody else wanted to create it as a trail of its own. However, had we got it into the Iditarod Trail, we wouldn't have had to worry about it. Still hasn't been approved.
Yeah.
It may never be approved.
But you're saying there was that missing piece. I mean, somehow, historically, when they were delivering mail, they had to get from the Gold Rush towns of Flat and Iditarod over to the river and over to
Unalakleet. Yeah, but they went back a different direction. Because they went back, and those little places that the trails came together, instead of going to the Yukon, there was no need to go to the Yukon because Anvik was already on a mail trail called the Yukon.
Right. They just had to cut across. But so how come with the race you needed to go through Ruby and up that way?
Two race trails that were over 1,000 miles long.
So
you heard it.
Right. So if you'd gone the old way, it wouldn't have been 1,000 miles.
And straight across, you'd lost a couple hundred miles.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, for us that were creating this race to Nome and, right. and the people on the other end working on it, that was a perfect solution. If you could get to the Yukon River here, you added that 200 right. mile to the race trail.
So in those early years, working with BLM was not the most productive?
No, working with BLM personnel, but the appointed ding-a-lings, ding-a-ling! The appointed people just didn't have, I mean, they had other things that they had to do, and they wouldn't focus one day out of the year or three meetings out of the year. Sometimes we didn't even have a meeting in the year because they didn't want to focus on it. They were too busy working on the scenic river that had the great falls and mm-hmm. so forth. And that just wiped out Iditarod.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, now there is a BLM position, sort of a trail.
Oh, there has been for quite some time.
Was there in the 80s when you were first involved?
There were people tied to the document in creating the document that when it got published, they kept one person on after that. And I checked the record. I could be off one way or another. Right. But the concept, when I finally became president, the concept of having somebody on full time became a standard for the Iditarod. And the committee was with us, with me, with us, 100% on doing that, because we knew if we didn't have somebody full-time, we'd end up in the archives somewhere, and that'd be it.
Well, I did look at that original comprehensive plan, and it's interesting, it was from 1981, mm-hmm. to read it and think, well, that didn't happen, that's not going on, you know.
And
so I was sort of wondering what happened there.
It was the head of the BLM that they sent to Alaska to do all these projects. And I don't want to say that they weren't doing something.
Right.
They just had too much to do. And they had darn few people to get it done. Alaska's BLM lands are the same size right. as BLM lands for the other 48 states.
Yeah. Definitely.
That's a massive piece of real estate.
It is. And never enough staff people.
Nope.
And yeah, they also, I guess they needed to have money to fund the project.
Really? You've got it right there.
The advisory council didn't have any role in that, did they?
If you took on a person and put them full time, and mind you, when we started out, our first person was a third time, either a quarter or a third time person. So he had other things that they had to do besides try to make Iditarod
right.
become a reality.
Right. Do you remember when you were president, when you became president?
December of 99, if I remember. That's when we finally shut off all direct assistance that BLM supposedly was doing for us. And the part-time or full-time person then became directly responsible. We gave them direction and so forth.
Okay. And then the advisory council, which was the first group,
yep.
that ended in 1998. And then Alliance.
And it took us another year to get to where they appointed me to be the first president.
Okay, so you were the president of the
yeah.
Alliance. Were you ever president of the council?
I think I was for 1980-something. I can't remember for sure, 88, 9, something
okay.
like that. And you sit through all these stupid meetings I've been telling you
right.
about.
Well, I was thinking it must maybe in 88 because I have a note that in 1988 was the first National Scenic and Historic Trail Conference, and that was held in Wisconsin, and that maybe you went to
represent the council. I went to that representing the Iditarod.
Yeah. So do you remember that?
Oh, I remember it well.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, it was the first real convening of the historic trails and the scenic trails as an entity. And there were all kinds of federal people there who were all playing games trying to hold on to their little entity and their incomes and so forth. And they just knew that this new group was going to get rid of all these federal people. That's always been the situation with government. Mm-hmm. People are more concerned about their job than they are about why they're there. And we got through there. I proposed a motion, and I can't remember what the heck it was, but at the end I proposed a motion to the floor that something in this conglomeration of making it work together was brought to the floor, and the federal people just about came unglued. They just knew that if this motion passed, if you were to get a hold of Gary Werner, he probably could cough all of that information up.
And who's he?
He was the... what was his official title? He of all the trails.
Oh yeah, I have his name here. He was instrumental in organizing the national partnerships.
Yep.
The Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin.
Yep, he was head of the Ice Age Trail. And we made him chairman of all of the trails under one envelope, period.
Okay. I know I'm looking here in my notes because I have a note here about something you proposed at that meeting for local groups, and I can't remember what it was. Let me just pause this for a second.
It's probably in the minutes, but I don't know. If we just really had the feeling that we didn't have control over what we were creating.
Well, that must have been frustrating.
Well, every step you take in life, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, but
sometimes,
to have...
Sometimes you're lucky to get two at a time, but it don't happen often.
But to have a system set up that then you as the local groups don't have any authority, that does seem like that would be frustrating.
Yeah, but the federal people wouldn't let go. It took a period of time before the federal people could see that this organization was the best thing that they could have going for them to guarantee they'd keep their jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that kind of a situation.
Oh, I found my note about what you proposed at that conference. That proposed that group organize a nonprofit coalition. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Coalition, yep. Bringing them all under one envelope.
Bringing all of the advisory councils under one envelope?
Bringing all, at that time it was 16 trails. It's now 39. And that was my great fear, was once we got this thing started, that everybody would want to get into it because there's federal money there, Well, every time you bring somebody in, you cut everything back down the line so you can pay them. And that was my fear back then. Well, time goes on, you're gone.
So your proposal didn't pass?
It eventually does pass. But, that was just the beginning. There are so many other things to be considered as you finally start, quote unquote, working together. And the National Historic Trails were pretty much in line. We had some that were sort of shaky. Some that were so shaky they didn't even have an organization back home. Period. and I'm trying to remember which one that was. One of the trails going through the mountains. But it doesn't make any difference. They finally came along.
But so was there then partnership and coordination with other national trail nonprofits?
Well, the intent was that we would all be working together to get that federal money into the budget, which would be took apart and spread out to fund the five different federal agencies that are participant in running the trail systems. It's not just BLM. It's the Park Service. It's this, it's that.
Forest Service.
Yep.
Is it State Parks?
Well, State Parks isn't part of the federal.
No, I know, but who would else be? BLM, Park Service, Forest Service.
Iditarod goes through U.S. Army land.
Oh.
See, so you've got it's just an odd connection of things. Most of them today have turned over the responsibility of the trail to the main system. So you don't have to go to the Department of Defense to get a $50,000 piece of money to fund the trail in there. It's all being done under the big trail system now.
So. Yeah, I mean, it would seem like the Iditarod Trail Advisory Council in Alaska partnering with a historic trail in California and partnering with another one in Wisconsin, that you guys could all help each other and learn from each other and advocate together.
You said it well.
That was your plan.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen.
Well, it didn't happen instantly because you've got all these managers sitting back here not wanting to give up of their authorities, their budgets, their, you name it. You've got Forest Service Trail here, and you've got BLM here, and you've got some other federal agency here, and they're all fighting each other to get a piece of whatever's coming for the trail. It was opening a Pandora's box at the beginning when we brought them all together.
But it eventually happened?
I think it has gone relatively well. I mean, if you get time to talk to Gary Werner, I think he is retiring now. Mm-hmm. He would be a source to give you the next step in why this works.
But he would be for the national level, not for the Alaska.
He was head of the Ice Age Trail for eons. Mm-hmm. So he has another perspective. That's not a historic trail.
Okay.
So,
and now, did you go to Washington, D.C.?
Several times.
And what did you do there?
Twiddled thumbs.
And what were you?
What do you do in Washington, D.C.?
I guess I should rephrase it. Why did you go there? Why were you sent there?
We were having this overall meeting of all the trails.
Okay.
Originally it was 16. It's now 39, and kept.
Everybody. So the trails conference or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
Okay. And so sometimes they had them in D.C.?
Yeah, sometimes they had them on a trail. There's several trails that come together in the middle of the country. We've had them there, the Mormon Trail, the Pacific Crest, all come together right there at St. Louis. So.
Okay. So was there advocacy in Congress?
We didn't have much problem in Alaska because, we don't have, at that time we only had, maybe 300,000-400,000 people. So you didn't have this conglomeration of pieces all over the place that were all fighting for their little bit, whatever was they were working at. And Alaska's probably feeling about the same as Hawaii. You're sort of disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to doing something, Hawaiian problem is completely different. Its native land claims is extensive as far as a piece of land.
Right. Well, Well, I know that you were one of the few people who went and represented the Iditarod Advisory Council on a national level, so it was just, you know, trying to get an idea of what you did, because nobody else was there.
True. And then eventually Judy was coming along with me, mm-hmm. and we never had problem with our delegation in Alaska, period. Ted Stevens was a godsend. Congressman Young, no problem whatsoever.
They all supported it.
Yep. Murkowski, the old man, he was pretty much there, but you didn't have the feeling it was secure. But it was three Republicans, and you knew that, you know, trail money wasn't going to go up the flue, mm-hmm. because one of them went off to cry in the corner or something. And with Lisa, she had never been a problem. Now, mind you, I have been sort of removed for five, 6 years.
Yeah, in those early days, like before Judy started going, and when you were the person going on behalf of the council. What had to happen at a national level, but going to those conferences?
Well, it looked like my daughter driving down. The real problem was to make sure that the BLM, our BLM person, was always funded, mm-hmm. and not half-time or three-quarter time, but became a full-time person. And that was an annual process of mm-hmm. increasing the funding for that BLM person. Iditarod is a BLM trail, in spite of the fact there are five federal agencies involved with the trail. So. Maybe more today, but
do you remember some of the other things that the council did, what they worked on, issues they had to take care of? Sort of like, what is the council responsible for?
Well, the trails are not always on federal land, so you end up in some instances, and I'm trying to think, Wyoming, Montana, there are some pieces of the trails that go through there that are in state or even county mm-hmm. lands. And it's a matter of getting them to release their authority to that so it becomes a total part of the federal.
So for the Iditarod, that means they were right of way. Easements, is that what you mean?
Yeah, we had a major one right up out of Wasilla that somebody had, in the process of statehood, had lands that they got title to from the state of Alaska that the historic trail went right through the middle of, or went through the side of, mm-hmm. or would split, so he had a Y in the middle of their property. And Judy Bittner could tell you more where that is today, mm-hmm. but those are private lands, and they have nothing to do with federal jurisdiction unless you can negotiate something with the people that's acceptable to make it federally open.
Do you want something to drink?
I'm fine, thank you.
Generally, with the Iditarod, in our process of setting it up, we have set aside 100-foot off-center line rights away throughout Alaska to guarantee that is federal land negotiated with the trail. And there are places it is only 25-foot wide, period, not center line. 25-foot wide because of the original federal act, which never recognized the 200-foot width, 100-foot off-center line.
But and the council, the advisory council, dealt with those right-of-ways, or that was all BLM negotiating?
And that was part of the original act.
Right, but to acquire a right-of-way and negotiate that with a landowner.
Yeah, but in the 25-foot right-of-way, see, native land claims was taking place at the same time.
Right.
So when they negotiated the trail, or the Iditarod National Historic Trail, the first historic trail, when they negotiated, that's why you see other trails having different problems. Each time's a new negotiation. Through native lands, they put a 25-foot corridor for the historic trail. And there are variations of 25 to 200 feet throughout Alaska for the historic trail. And I don't know where all that is because that's still ongoing. Yeah. And I know some of the native land claims had one point were getting close to some kind of negotiation to widen the trail. Except when you get to east of Solomon, the trail comes through, goes right through the middle of a cemetery. Brilliant people down there in D.C., you know.
That wasn't your guys' choice?
No, it wasn't our choice.
I guess I would have thought.
And we have come to an accord with the Native Corporation to move the trail very much out of the corridor of that cemetery.
Well, that's a good example for my question, which is, how was the trail mapped out? Did the advisory council decide we wanted to go here, 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 and here? Or BLM drew the line on the map?
Someone at BLM drew the line.
Okay.
And I'm sure it's a pencil line somewhere.
Well, no, but your example made me wonder, how I assumed there was an obvious route and it would just be...
And Judy was a lot closer to some of that, and she might have the answer to that question if you want to ask her of it.
Right.
It just amazed me as you're going along down in the valley, coming up the mountains, why you've got these 200-foot right-of-ways, and of course you have to move them a little bit because there's a development here, and someone has a summer fish camp there, and there's an old cabin that's been there since 1902 and that burned to the ground in 1974. It was an original checkpoint.
Oh.
And of course it's gone.
Right.
And nobody's out there building a new one to take its place.
No, that's what happens.
Yep.
So why has it been important to you to have the Iditarod Trail designated as a historic trail?
It has more than just a dog mushing potential. It can become a full trail system through Alaska from sea to shining sea.
Is it only possible to do that as a winter trail, or can it be done as a other season?
I think if the trail accedes to a use where people are willing to come to Alaska in the summer and hike a piece of it that has never been hiked before, is never this, is never that. Mind you, we've had people walk from Seward to Nome.
In the last couple decades.
No.
In the winter.
And a bike.
Yes. Oh, yeah,
yeah, bikes. Bike. Yeah, but that's all when it's frozen.
Remember the first guy that walked there, it took him 50-some days or something?
He was from Italia, wasn't he?
No, not the Italian. There was one before that, an old fellow. Hmm. Old, yeah. 60-some years old.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, you get out there in the flats out there, it's all swamp and river, and that you could only do it once it's frozen.
Go down, take a look at pieces of the trail between Seward and Anchorage. I mean, they're building stuff right over the top of it, so you're walking on a tread of some sort, either boards or
yeah.
rock or so forth. You can walk almost the way from Seward up to where the trail goes up over the mountain.
To Hope.
Yeah, Hope. You can walk almost all the way now.
Yeah, but I was thinking like from Knik and out into Iditarod and...
No, I know.
That's a big...
You and I aren't going to be here to see it done.
Big river.
Mind you, it will be attractive enough that people will be willing to have federal funding spent to put that trail in.
Mm-hmm. And so when you got involved in the 80s, you envisioned it as something like that even back then?
Oh, I think I had envisioned of something like that from Fairbanks to Nome. There's been umpteen... 1927, they first surveyed all the way from Fairbanks to Nome for a road. It's never been built. They're out there surveying it now.
I know there's been a proposal for a railroad to Nome as well.
Yeah. But until that railroad comes from Russia, it's not going to go to Nome. Not to haul one train load of fuel.
Right. Are there other things you can think of that the council or the alliance have done that you've been involved with?
Well, I think we have, I say we, 5-6 years removed, I think that the council has continued to put pressure on BLM. Not that they need it, they just need the guidance to make sure the funding is there. And there is a continuation of putting in more permanent trail from Seward to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
If they finish that, there'll be the rest of the trail will be a piece of sweet cake, comparatively speaking, because you've got all those valleys like this, you have to build a bridge across, or you've got to find some way to go clear around to get to that point. And then they're building dams yet.
Well, modern technology, we all want all these new things, right?
You do know they're building a dam, or were building a dam that would wipe out 20-some miles of the historic trail.
No. Where was that?
Between Seward and Anchorage, of course.
Where are they proposing to build a dam?
Oh, I've driven through there. There are actually about 4 locations that have been recommended, and all of them are right along the highway. When you get down along the long lake in there, the L-shaped lake,
yeah,
it's right in there, and then as you come over the pass, just before you get over the pass, there's another one up in there.
Yeah, I've not heard about those.
Your good friend in Seward can name them.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, are you still on the Alliance?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. But you were on...
I'm a has-been.
No, but you were on the council, and then it switched to the Alliance.
Yeah.
You were there during that.
Well, yeah, we were the people that switched it, because...
Why did it switch?
So we had control over what was going on, instead of having to wait for the BLM to come to us with their either lack of or proposals. We had meetings that were just absolutely a waste of federal money because nothing. One of them, the manager, never even bothered to show up for. He was busy rafting down some river somewhere else in Alaska.
Is there any, well, I guess when you were involved, was there any management being done of the trail? Like brushing it out and putting up signs and things like that?
Yes.
And
I say that advisedly because most of what has been done on the trail has been funded as a volunteer effort, period. From clear back in the 60s right up to current day. Iditarod, the race, because of its race manager, puts together an effort to go out and brush parts of the trail every year. And he does get some funding for flying machines out and so on and so forth. I'm not even familiar for the last 5 years what's being done, but I would guess it. He's still alive. He's still a race manager. I'm sure he's still doing it for the benefit of the race, really.
Mm-hmm. Who is that now?
Is that the Trailblazer group?
Well, Trailblazers have something to do with it. I don't want to call him manager, not the race manager.
The trail manager?
No, the trail judge.
Oh.
The head man for all of the race judges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I can see him for me, but I can't remember his name.
He was the one who painted the monument, or shellacked, varnished the monument the last time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he was in Nome for a while.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about, he'd
be a good one to talk to about the current situation.
Right. Well, and I know that there's the Nome Trailblazers and Knik Trailblazers and the Seward Trailblazers.
Yeah, I created the Nome Trailblazers. Oh. And if they function today, more power to them.
I don't know if they're still functioning. But
no, I don't.
So
think,
when did you create them? Well, what was
I was always creating something. Creating more trouble than anything else.
Well, what was the reason for creating them?
Well, first of all, we had to put out mileposts that were more permanent than a trail stake stuck in the ground with a pie plate on mm-hmm. it. And that's, for years, that's all there was. I put together a group of people in Nome, and we put in tripods on the mileposts of the historic trail all the way into Nome from Solomon. And there were a few before Solomon. And that would have been, it would have been a tripod like mm-hmm. this. And these two legs right here with it like this would have a sign on it that had 106 or 299, whatever the milepost was. Mm-hmm. Then there would be an arrow on this side that would be pointing down the trail, which would say south, mm-hmm. have the letter S with an arrow off of it. The other side would have one with N with an arrow pointing up. And that was all my design mm-hmm. Of trying to give permanent designation to the trail and which way you were going if you came to one of the mileposts.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of lath and stuff out there now. In between each of the mileposts.
So each of those tripods with the sign, they were each a mile apart?
Yep. And they were made out of beech logs, anywhere from 6 to 8 inches in diameter. And then I actually drilled holes in the top where the three logs came together mm-hmm. and put a bolt through there and bolted it together.
So the lovely Bering Sea wind wouldn't knock them down.
Well, the Bering Sea has carried several of the tripods away.
Oh, have they?
Yep.
I thought the Trailblazers maybe, went out and broke trail and figured they marked it, but...
Well, in the winter, it's not hard to mark because you just stick a piece of lath in the hard snow.
Yeah, but that goes away.
Well, in the summer, in the spring, it melts and they
Well,
fall
and I was
over.
Thinking it doesn't make it marked as an official historic trail.
That's why I put the tripods mm-hmm. in. As on a clear day, you can see tripods right. for miles.
Now, is the rest of the trail marked that way?
No. Nope.
Only what you did?
No. Nope. Only because I lived in Nome did it get done.
Okay.
And I had an agreement with a musher from Caltag and a musher Callen? In Uniclete, huh?
Oh, Edgar Callen, way back?
Yeah, way back.
He Callen. He was on the first council.
Not Callen. I'm talking about one that ran the Iditarod in 1977. Mm-hmm. And he was,
Peters.
He was no, he was the one that got run over by that snow machine.
Oh.
Doesn't matter. And other history.
Lots of history.
Oh, tons of it. There's history for every musher that's ever run the Iditarod. Right.
Well, there's another thing. Nowadays, that Iditarod Trail, as you say, it's used for people biking, snow machine race. The Iron Dog snow machine race is on that parts of that trail.
Oh, yeah.
And who decided that these different things can happen, or if it was supposed to be just for dog mushing?
BLM. And those mushers have to do certain things and make certain requirements and so forth. BLM has done a pretty legitimate job. I can't speak for the last 5 years.
No, but while you were, we're just talking about when you were involved, yeah.
And I worked directly when I was president, when I was on the pre-board and so forth, with Mike, what the heck was his name? He was priceless. He's retired.
Of BLM?
Michael?
I'm trying to remember his last name.
I'm looking in my notes here.
Where is he from?
He was from Anchorage then. I don't know he's retired and where he is.
He was
now.
The BLM guy?
Yeah, the hireling. Not the manager. Oh. But he was BLM's representative to Iditarod. And he was always challenged to do this and that and so forth. Real good guy.
Well, for BLM, some of the early, well, this was the early days. Kerry Brown, Terry O'Sullivan, Steve Peterson.
Yeah, those are very early.
Yeah.
That's before there was any organization, really.
Yeah, I have 79 to 81.
Yeah, that's putting that big book together.
Yeah.
Have you seen the book?
Yes.
Okay.
The library has it. Yeah, I see that I have the names of who were the first appointed in January 1981, the first council members. Joe Reddington, Clay Beal, he was Department of Agriculture, William Coghill, Floyd Sherrock, Chip Dennerline, Ken Chase, Ray Collins, Leroy Davey, Wilda Hudson, Andy Edge from Nome.
What a waste.
Jack Garrison of Big Lake, Shirley Heatwell, Anchorage, Edgar Callen, but he died shortly thereafter, so he wasn't on very long. Fritz Livesay, Michael Meehan, Roderick Perry, Clyde Peters, he was from Galena, Rosemary Phillips from Nome, Dan Seavey, and Mary Shields from here.
There were six people on there that were worth their weight. Period. I just kept track of the names.
Do you want to say whom or not?
I don't know. Do you want me to say who or not?
I'm happy to get your opinion on the organization and what
I worked with a number of the people, and then about half of them weren't there by the time I got involved.
Right.
They'd already flew the coop or died or whatever.
Well,
I don't know.
As we know, many of these sorts of organizations, not everybody stays as long as somebody like you or Dan Seavey.
I know.
Or now Judy, she's been involved for a long time.
She's probably been there as long now as I was there long.
Right.
So.
But just those early years. So on these names, were some of these people ones you worked with once you got involved?
Yeah.
Such as?
Right. Just hand me the list.
I don't know if you can read my...
Don't lose the page.
It's up here. If you can read my bad handwriting.
Well, Joe Sr. Bill Coghill. I was amazed to find out he was on there. Department of Transportation. Yeah. Interesting.
So he was
Ken Chase. He was one of the original mushers the first year of the Iditarod, and ran several times afterwards. Andy Edge was a city manager. Nome was worthless.
Utility manager.
Well, he was city manager too. Oh. Yeah.
So he was sort of put on there to represent the city of Nome,
I assume so.
Yeah.
Edgar Calland was priceless.
Yeah, unfortunately, he was appointed in January and died in April, which is too bad.
Rod Perry was probably worth something, but I could never find what he was worth.
So he wrote a book, didn't he?
Huh?
Didn't he write a book?
Yeah, well, it was his writing the book that left you on the edge.
So what was his role? Where was he from or why?
Chugiak.
Okay. So was he appointed as a musher?
He ran the Iditarod a couple of times. Rosemary Phillips, at that time that was 81. Yeah, she may have been the executive director of Iditarod.
Mm.
And Dan Seavey and Mary Shields. Mary was priceless.
Yeah, both were mushers. And like you, Dan has been very outspoken about the importance of history.
Oh, yeah. But he came to Alaska in 64 as a teacher.
Right. I know, so why is the history so important to you?
Why is Iditarod? I don't know.
Good question.
Why is it?
Good question.
we probably have invested $500,000 in Iditarod. And, why is it important? It's a good thing to waste your money on.
Well,
I think it's just because he likes to be involved in something.
Well, this is more than something.
Yeah, I don't know. Good question.
There's no question the values of history and trying to preserve something. You know, they talk about that historic trail.
Right.
But that historic trail wasn't just a gold rush trail. The native people who lived here went back and forth on that trail for thousands of years. I mean, we have proof of that right out on the Bering Sea, right along the coast. That trail has been used forever. That's what irritated me about not getting the Yukon River in. It had been used forever. Period.
Yeah. Well, you know, I will admit that before I started this project, I would have assumed the historic trail designation came out of the dog race. I didn't know that history of the gold rush in Hope and Sunrise and the mail delivery from Seward and it going all the way.
That's because the dog race gave it identification. There was no real identification unless you read a history book somewhere.
Right. So you feel like the...
the race saved the trail.
Okay.
Yeah. Quite simple.
Now, do you feel like the trail is being protected? No, I don't know. That wasn't a very good question. I kind of lost my train of thought.
In one sense, it's probably overprotected. It depends how you look at it. When you're trying to do something, to put something permanently in place, and you've got to fight your own government to do anything, even when you're willing to fund it, and that'll go on for a long time, long beyond you and I, dear.
Well, I guess my question was, do you feel like it's been a good thing that it got designated as a historic trail?
No question. Absolutely no question. Probably should have been done in 1920s.
But it wasn't historic. It was a used trail, maybe.
1920s, there weren't airplanes either.
Right.
And that was yet to come. And, of course, that wiped out the trail.
Having been on the council and the alliance, I feel that system has worked or not worked and why.
There were periods of time that I thought we should have fired them all. Period. Especially when that idiot went off on a floating trip down some river, or some wild and scenic river that was more important than the historic trail. There were times, you know, I think all of us would have thought twice about coming back to the next meeting. And of course, you may get different variations of that when you talk to the people, but after going and seeing how, you know, some of the Appalachian Trail, 1818, and piecing it together for all that time, and having people going out there every 2 or 3 years to rebuild a set of stairs going up this side of the mountain and putting bridges in across rivers that washed out the bridge the previous spring and so forth. You know, they've kept that trail going since 1818. And it wasn't much of a trail then. It was the back country. And
so do you see things that could be done in Alaska to create that same momentum for the Iditarod Trail?
Oh, I think there's a lot that could be done. And woe and behold that I should go tell people how to do something.
Well, no, just ideas you might have.
I have an idea for you.
Okay.
Yeah, see?
Well, or are there things...
I have floated a lot of ideas about trying to do something with the trail. And just like putting those tripods in, thank God that Mother Nature made them strong enough, because two-thirds of them are still there today. I set a committee up, and each tripod had a particular person in charge of that tripod. And that worked. Well, the tripods last all by themselves. And when you put a good-sized bolt through the head of that, you know, the worst thing that can happen is it falls out. Well, there's enough weight, it's not going to fall out.
So what were some of the other ideas you floated?
Just trying to think my way through. I just establishing the mileage of the trail was a real contest, because you had a trail that went two different ways, and neither of them were the same mileage. So you had to, you could either take the mileage and go straight across from McGrath to crossing the Yukon River, or you go the two bypasses, and if you went across the river, you ended up with about 790 miles to Nome. But if you went around either one of these, it was over 1,000 miles.
And it sounds better to have it be 1,000, is that
why? Oh, yeah. No question about it.
But yeah, what about though, these ideas of getting...
Remember, when they first set the Iditarod up, they set it up to be a 1,000-mile race, so you couldn't come up with less mileage.
Right. I was thinking other ideas for kind of promoting public stewardship and excitement about this historic trail, not about the dog race, we got plenty of that, but about the historic trail and why it should be maintained and protected, like you said, the Appalachian Trail.
That, I think, is harder until I tried at one point to use the mileage posts, the tripods, as a process of getting people involved historically in the Iditarod, and I never crossed that threshold.
And what about on the
other
parts?
You could buy the rights to tripod 739, whatever, wherever it is, middle of the Yukon River, but you have to maintain it, which means you have to go get on the Yukon River and go down to 939 and put something along the edge of the river that shows where 939 is, or 739, whatever.
Well, and it does seem like the Anchorage, or, you know, now it's Big Lake, to Nome, section of the historic trail gets attention because of the dog race,
oh,
as you
absolutely.
Said. But the other part, the Seward to Knik part, is there public interest in that section, and how do you get that excitement going?
I tried to, the fellow at the library down there, I'm trying to remember.
Lee? Lee?
Yeah, Lee. I tried to get Lee interested in creating an event on that portion of the trail, but it isn't continuous yet. And I think, I mean, you can walk the railroad all the way to Anchorage, mm-hmm. but that's not the trail. It's a part of the trail, but it's not the trail.
Did it go over Crow Pass? Is that how it, from Girdwood, did it go up over Crow Pass down
the railroad?
No, the trail.
Oh, the one of the trails goes up over Crow Pass, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you been up there?
No. But
Do it sometime. It'll give you an experience you'll be writing about the rest of your life.
That's why I haven't done it. And now, yes, you could walk along the inlet, Turnagain Arm, and there are a number of trails now that go
Some of that trail is almost impassable.
Which, the Crow Pass?
We've walked up.
Around Anchorage?
Yeah. It's incredible. You're going, I mean, there wasn't any road down below.
I know.
And you had to go over those sheer cliffs.
Yeah.
You had to go over the top.
Because
they were taking mules over that stuff.
I was thinking that now there might be a trail all the way from Anchorage to Girdwood.
There's
a bicycle path, but...
Oh, there is down on the bottom.
Yeah, but...
But not back where the actual trail
is. Not the actual trail went.
Yeah.
Because I know there were a lot of trails in there, but... Well, I think we've kind of touched on all my big questions.
Well, you run into something, pick the phone up.
Oh, the other thing I was thinking of, just interpretive signs and guides. I know they've put out a lot of publications and things, but...
Bill... Oh, they made the Iditarod sign out of plywood. Remember, they spray painted them and so forth. They had the red and white stripes on it and the dog head on it.
Yeah.
We got one out in the garage somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bill, what was it?
Well, as I say, I know the...
I don't know who did it.
The race certainly gets lots of attention and people know about the trail, but I don't know that the public realizes it's a national historic trail.
No, I know they don't. Second year, Bill Devine made these beautiful signs out of 3-inch or 3/4-inch plywood, mm-hmm. with the emblem and the dog face on it and so
right.
forth. It was shaped like the emblem, and I don't know, they made 100 of them, and they went out and put them up on the trail along the way to show where the trail was. You want to know what? There wasn't one sign left come next year.
Because people took them as collectors?
They were so beautiful they couldn't.
we've
got one
souvenirs.
Out here that Bill gave to me. So.
Oh, gosh.
But that would have been on the race route. Right.
Well, that's pretty much on the Iditarod Trail going out of Anchorage anyway.
Oh, right.
That's where they put them up.
Because the dog logo is the same for the... What's the...
It's the same.
Yeah.
That is the official logo.
Yeah.
I know I've got it somewhere in this house. It's not on the wall, I don't think.
No, but I know it. I've seen it. I was going to ask who designed that, because the historic trail has its own logo, which is different from your race logo.
I wouldn't approve that one, except everybody was so glorified.
And now I can't quite remember what it looks like, but...
It's green on white or something like that.
Do you remember who did it?
I think she did.
She?
But I have no idea who did it. I mean, that was just some of the stuff that was going along as we were trying to get ourselves organized and so forth.
Who is she?
Who is she?
She lives across from where Tokars live.
Oh, Bittner, you mean?
Yeah, Judy Bittner.
Oh.
Yeah.
They hired somebody or something?
I have no idea. She had access to all that with the state job she had. So.
But as you say, an organization, you form a board, you make... your bylaws, and you have meetings, and you get a logo, and right, that's all that kind of stuff.
That's all that happens. Perfunctory stuff, you know. I don't know how many legal entities I've put together in my life, but there's got to be 20, 25, yeah, maybe 30 that I've put together. It's all sort of standard garbage anyway, so.
Yeah. And so do you feel like the advisory council, you're glad you were on it, or do you feel it was a waste of your time?
Oh, no, it wasn't a waste of time. I was too intertwined with Iditarod. I mean, it wasn't just the historic part of it. It was starting the race and being there to make sure. See, I had a project for 45 years of Iditarod. Every year, mushers carried official mail. Every musher carried official mail over the trail. Hand-canceled in Anchorage at the post office. Hand-canceled in Nome on the day, date, a.m. or p.m. that musher delivered the mail. In fact, I'll get you some.
Well, I knew that they did that. I knew they carried mail. I didn't realize that it was hand-canceled and that they had to have it canceled in Nome.
Oh, yes. Either you do something right or don't do it all. And I set out, because I've collected stamps ever since I was 7 years old, and that is a part of me. Well, you got involved, I don't know how many different cachet-type projects. When we first flight from Nome to Russia, we had all kinds of stuff that went with that, and I don't know how many other mail projects we've had.
Well, I mean, it makes sense for the Iditarod because it was
a mail trail.
A mail trail to start with.
Well, Iditarod got rid of that when when I departed. They don't do anything. That's work, you know. Not only work, but you have to sell it. And they couldn't sell the doggone mail.
Well, I think you could probably sell just about anything and an idea.
Are you for sale?
I think having you on a committee.
How much is that worth?
Having you on a committee, I think you'd have lots of ideas and be pretty good salesman.
Yeah, we've been through a lot. 53 years here in a month, in a week. So.
Oh, great. You have some notes there. Is there something you wanted to talk about?
Oh, this was something. When I first ventured to Alaska, I ended up working at KUAC.
Oh.
Originally, it was KUOA. But they found out Alabama had a KUOA, so they had to go back and redo things, and they got KUAC. Well, in the process, when I got involved with it, it became an FM station. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody listened to it, but it was an FM station. And I am supposed to turn something in down here, little thing to help promote their funding every year. So, and in 1964, the station became professionalized and entered the U of A's responsibility. Before that, it was a student-owned radio station.
I didn't know that.
Most people don't even know that. Even the students who were there didn't know it. And it became sort of professionalized, and responsibility and the tutelage passed on to the university, became staff responsibility to make sure this all took place instead of the student union body. Mm-hmm. So and for about 60 years, KUAC-FM has existence. You, the listeners, have gratuitously funded our programming and the operation. It's what I was going to give to them. I haven't gotten to the station yet.
No, you could probably phone it into them.
Well, I don't know. I'll go down and talk to them. It's a bunch of young punk kids anyway.
Well, anything else about the Iditarod National Historic Trail and your involvement with that?
I just I look at those initial 3 years of starting the race, and we are so lucky that the Humane Society was so stupid it didn't come and kill the race. We had trouble with the Humane Society for years.
Oh yeah. Well, and
right down to the last minute before starting the race, and then get an injunction from the court to stop them from doing their thing, and the race started on time.
Well, and nowadays nutrition science for dogs has advanced so much, and veterinary medicine and all those things. I mean, but those original mail carriers, I mean, what were they feeding their dogs to keep them healthy? Fish? I don't know.
Yeah, fish, reindeer, moose.
So I was just asking whether the dogs that worked the original mail trail or the serum run or whatever, did they end up in Nome skinny and malnourished like that first race teams?
My experience of talking with the diphtheria serum run and so forth, those were professionally used dogs, and they had to maintain certain standards with their dogs at the kennels, or they wouldn't have been a musher transporting the mail, the freight, and so forth. Having talked at length with Edgar and so forth over the time, Edgar Callan.
Oh, Callan, okay.
And talked to, I'm trying to remember the other musher, he and his wife were at the house, and they were in their late 80s when they were there. They had 12 kids.
Well, yeah, I mean, those dogs, I mean, they didn't have high-tech nutritional science to keep their dogs fit and healthy. Maybe they rested them more, or they went shorter legs than the race was making people go.
Well, when we did the diphtheria serum run, we hauled it by the train from Seward to
Nenana,
and then from there down, we replicated every actual segment going to Nome. So you had 20, 30 miles of trail, which if you've got a well-rested dog team, man, they're often gone.
Yeah, and whereas the race, people were pushing those limits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that makes sense why it would be different.
I never heard anything over the course of years about mishandled dogs involved with carrying freight and mail on the trail. Now, aside from that, you know, you've got a dog kennel and you're using them to go fishing in the summer, and you're having to house them during the summer and get food for them and all that stuff. There's ups and downs that take place. I can't help but know that abuse has taken place.
It must have, yeah.
Yeah. But the professional stuff, they needed their animals because they were making their living with
it. That's true.
And the living came during the winter.
Right.
Which was a tough time for a living. So.
Right. All right. Well, that finished up that. Thank you very much. I'm going to turn this off.